I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking to the other side of the drug debate. I'm going to talk to a guy who has worked to shut down a safe injection site. His is not a perspective that I've had a lot of time for before today. You know, the NIMBY perspective, the not in my backyard perspective. These people just have so much less skin in the game than everybody else involved. But you can't say that about this guy.
I have a brother with schizophrenia who's lived on the streets for 17 years. He's free to live on the streets, and nobody's going to pick him up and put him in an asylum like we did back in 1890, but he's going to die out there.
Supposed to keep an open mind, supposed to always, you know, talk to the other side of the story, but you develop biases. There's no way around it. If you cover things, you feel a way about them after a while. And I've got mine. I have a bias about the opioid crisis. I think I came by it honestly. I didn't have any strong pre-existing feelings about, you know, the drug crisis until I started reading about how drug users are spoken of in the Canadian press. It's just gross. Like, over the years, there's like Rick Bell in the Calgary Sun calling drug users scumbags, Globe and Mail's Margaret Wente, who is questioning whether it's really worth saving their lives with naloxone when people OD, Mark Tuohy, Post-Media columnist. He wrote, there is zero point keeping people alive just to suffer in perpetual misery. You get a situation like the opioid crisis, over 47,000 people have died from opioid toxicity between 2016 and March of this year. And the press, like from this position of power and comfort, actually writing that these people's lives are worthless. And, you know, it's evolved into this political thing. It's the politicization of whether or not to actually invest in keeping these people alive. We know how to keep them alive. I've been educated about this by Garth Mullins. You've heard him on the show before. He's the host of the excellent show Crackdown, and he's a drug user. And he told me what's really going on. What's really going on is that we know how to keep addicts alive. You give them drugs. But we have a stigma about that. We have a moral problem with just handing out hard narcotics to addicts because we consider it a moral failure that they are addicts, even though we know it's a health problem. It's a mental health problem. It's a public health crisis. But if you give them the drugs that they want, they will stay alive if they are given safe supply, if they are given safe injection sites where if they happen to overdose, they can be revived. They will stay alive. It works a lot better than rehab. We know that from the research. That's what I've been educated on over the years. And where it doesn't work, why it hasn't been working, is because we're not doing it right. We still have a stigma about giving people drugs like fentanyl or heroin. And so instead, people are given safe supply to drugs they don't want, that pharmaceutical companies want to sell them or sell the governments that hand them out. Hydromorphone and drugs that I guess are still very strong, but perhaps less euphoric and less fun. And so what happens is addicts who are addicted to one drug are given a drug that does not quite scratch that itch. And so they sell it or trade it. And that creates a market for drug dealers to come and give them fentanyl or heroin that in many cases is toxic. And for everybody around this, it creates criminal drug activity in the neighborhoods around these public health services, safe injection and safe supply. If we actually did this right, if we actually had enough safe injection sites, there are only 100 safe injection sites in the entire world, and 37 of them have been in Canada. But that's not nearly enough to get the research and the data to know if this works. If you're not going to do safe supply properly and give people the right drugs, you don't know if it works. And so I've watched it get politicized, and I've watched Pierre Poilievre seize upon these very predictable negative consequences of doing it wrong and appeal to people's most base impulses. It looks awful. What's happening in downtown of our cities looks dangerous, needles on the ground. And I throw up in my mouth a little bit when he pretends to care about these people, and that's why he's really going to invest in rehab. And I just don't believe that from the Conservative Party leader. I have my biases about this. I have my bias against Doug Ford when he announced that he's shutting down 10 of Ontario's 17 safe injection sites.
Well, you know something, I just don't believe these safe consumption sites. I've listened to the people in the neighborhoods, I've consulted with them, I've been getting endless phone calls about needles being in the parks, needles being by the schools and by the daycare. That's unacceptable. Giving someone, an addict, a place to do their injections. This was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's the worst thing that could ever happen to a community to have one of these safe injection sites in their neighborhood. And I was just wondering how you would feel if I stuck one of these beside your house. You wouldn't like it. Matter of fact, I know you wouldn't like it. Neither would your neighbors and neither would anyone else. And all the kids, they shouldn't be by schools. They shouldn't be by daycares. And in Leslieville, endless calls nonstop on my cell phone about thank you for doing this. And we are going to support these people that have issues and addictions. We're going to support them better than ever before.
So that was Ontario Premier Doug Ford thinking that he knows me, assuming that I would share his moral disgust because of a few needles. And I want to say to him when he says, how would you feel if I put it in your backyard? I want to say to him, man, bring it on. These people's lives are more important. But that's easy for me to say because it's not in my backyard. My guest today is Derek Finkel. He's a journalist and an author, and he is a dad in a neighborhood where one of these centers was put in his backyard. One of his neighbors, a mom of two young kids, got shot. I've been reading Derek Finkel's articles in the National Post about the opioid crisis, and they've challenged my bias. And I've invited him here today to challenge my opinions about this in conversation. Wait for it.
It all began in this parkette next to the South Riverdale Community Health Center, a supervised safe injection site where three men were hanging out.
One guy came up to them, but they started chasing him right away. They got him on the ground, beating him, and he finally got away, got up and ran across the street. He turned around with a gun, and that's where the stray bullet hit that woman, I guess.
When police arrived, they treated a woman in her 40s with multiple gunshot wounds. She was rushed to hospital, where sadly, she was pronounced dead. Now people here in Leslieville tell me the victim, who has yet to be identified by police, was a mother with school-aged children. So much sadness in this neighborhood and a place where everyone should feel safe.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jesse.
Derek, what happened in your neighborhood at the Riverdale Health Center?
South Riverdale Community Health Center opened an injection site, or sometimes called supervised consumption sites, in late 2017. There was no protest. There was no, nobody was up in arms about it. I think we all assumed that the drug using would happen inside the building and that it wouldn't really affect our neighborhood. We found out within, you know, a year or so that we were incredibly wrong in assuming that this site wasn't going to cause problems or that it was something that the health center was going to be able to manage. And things changed pretty quickly once the site was up and running. We started to see a lot of open use in the immediate vicinity of the site. We also started to see a lot more needles around, not just on the perimeter of the site, but in, you know, within 100 to 200 meters of the site. It was starting to get more and more problematic. There are two elementary schools there. There's now six daycare facilities within 150 meters of the site. We also started to see assaults. There was verbal threats. We started to see psychosis. Crime started to, especially theft, started to really increase. And I myself had an episode where it finally kind of came to a head. I mean, I had minor dealings where I would find, you know, needles on my son's hockey net, like in our backyard and that kind of thing. And I would bring them to the center and say, hey, what gives? In the spring of 2021, which was, you know, a year into the pandemic, and obviously things got worse during the pandemic for a number of reasons, but the area outside the center started to really get chaotic and out of control, especially considering that there are 100 children who live on my street. It's a one block street, and most of them go to the local public school, Moore Street Junior Public School, which is literally across the street from the health center, or less than 100 meters from the health center. And one day I was following two approximately 8-year-old girls who were walking together beside the health center. And I was behind them. I was maybe like 10, 15 feet behind them. I didn't know them. And as they turn the corner, there's a little parquet between the health center and there's a Presbyterian church. There's a little green area.
Mm-hmm.
And that had basically become, by 2021, an open-air drug market, you know, for use and drug dealers. And these two girls came around the corner and they suddenly stopped in their tracks. And there was a man and a woman who were basically in a fist fight, barely able to stand. And then there were two men, grown men, leaning against the health center wall with tourniquets around their arms, and they were shooting up. And these 2 8-year-old girls were, you know, I don't know if they lived on my street. I didn't recognize them, but I basically had to escort them to where they were going to get them on their way. They were both pretty shaken up. They didn't really know what to do, like to stop, turn around, keep going. So I just got them on their way. And then I went into the health center and I was pretty enraged because this has been going on for a while. And when I went in and I said I wanted to speak to the manager of the supervised injection site, I was told she wasn't there. She was working out of Toronto East General. I ended up having a phone conversation with her. But it's worth noting that when I went in, every time I went in to the health center to talk about this activity that was going on, that especially wasn't appropriate for children, I was always given the same answer, the same lecture, which is that, you know, this should be a teachable moment for your children. And, you know, this is how, you know, you should be, you know, parenting. And at this time, when they said that to me, I finally said, you know, this isn't a teachable moment. This is a terrifying moment. And, you know, we've had children had beer cans thrown at their head. We've had children in the backs of cars just driving home and had people attack the cars. We had one neighbor, somebody came out high from the center, walked down our street and threatened to burn a woman's house down with her children in the house. It became very clear that the center had very little control over what was going on around it. And I'll just end this part by saying that I did end up speaking on the phone for an hour to the person who was in charge of the site at that time. You know, she tried to beg it off on what was going on with respect to the pandemic and that society's most vulnerable were feeling it the most. And I once again felt this sort of patronizing sort of lecture from this person. And I just said, you know, society's most vulnerable are the children in my neighborhood. There's 100 of them on my street. They can't go to school. They can't use splash pads. These lanes behind our houses, which back onto this, your mismanaged health center, your injection site, they're spilling into our lanes. Like, we had children literally having to ride their bikes around prostrate, unconscious bodies and people, you know, injecting into their arms. And I begged her at that time. I said, you know, I don't understand how this can exist without security around the building. Like, how can you have us, you know, all these schools and daycares right there, and then you have basically a drug emporium happening on the exterior of your building? And she just said, well, there's no budget for security. And I'll just end by saying that they finally found budget for security on July 7th of 2023, within a couple hours of a local mother in our neighborhood being shot and killed during a dispute between three drug dealers outside of the injection site. That's when they got security. They found the budget after the shooting.
I feel like you buried the lead there. Somebody got killed. What can you tell me about that?
In the weeks leading up to the shooting, I finally started to connect with many of my neighbors. We became so sort of concerned about what was going on around the site. And for several years, we realized that the health center was not really responding to our concerns. So we finally decided to embark on our own research project, and we, as a community, collected data about the number of instances of, you know, needles, open use, violence, drug dealers, et cetera, et cetera. And we compiled those statistics, and we finally arranged for a meeting with the CEO of the health center in late June, so just a couple of weeks before the shooting. The parents who were representing the different streets in our neighborhood who were in the meeting were pretty upset. And they, one of them said, you know, I don't know what it's going to take for you guys to do something. But does a child have to get killed or seriously injured? And then, you know, 3 days later, I was up in Northern Ontario taking my son on a fishing trip. And I was getting calls from reporters at the Toronto Star and elsewhere about this shooting. And I just went back to what happened in that meeting and what was said. And it didn't turn out to be a child that was injured. It was the mother of two young children, a 44-year-old local mother. Three drug dealers got into a gunfight and killed. Her name was Carolina Huebner-Macarat.
She was an innocent bystander just walking down the street.
Correct. She was getting a smoothie at lunchtime.
And there was some kind of altercation between three suspected drug dealers, I guess?
The police have made it known that they were drug dealers. Their working theory is that, based on the video and so forth, is that two of them tried to rob the third one, and that's what, well, of drugs or money, and that's why the guns got pulled and fired.
I'm really glad to speak with you because I have opinions about this. I'm not an active player in any of these issues. It's just something that I've had conversations on the show about, and I formed opinions about them. And as it's become such a political issue, such a controversial issue, such a divisive issue, I think I've probably gotten dug in over the years. I've gotten a little bit cynical about it because I see what Pierre Poilievre is doing and the way that he is using people's disgust with what's happening to a lot of downtowns in Canada to present a case for his campaign. And I don't believe him when he says that he's got a better plan for the welfare of these actual people. I have my biases with this. And I've spoken to Garth Mullins, who hosts a show called Crackdown.
I know who Garth Mullins is.
And I guess he was an activist, but also a storyteller and a journalist of sorts, an interesting kind of journalist who's, I think, done incredible work telling some of these stories. When I've read contradictory pieces or coverage or journalism that's challenging these centers, I'm often suspicious of it because of how politicized it is and because it's become such a conservative talking point. What you've written is from such a personal perspective, and I've got some things in common with you. I'm a dad in downtown Toronto, and it drew such a stark contrast between what I'd like to think I believe and what I might believe if I were in your shoes. Let me go on a little bit, because what I want you to do is help me to challenge my opinions on this, which I think is a healthy thing to do. In general, I feel like if you decide to live and raise kids in the downtown of a city, you are opting in to live amongst all kinds of people. And
I agree.
You do have teachable moments. You are not cloistering your kids off from the world. And I have had uncomfortable and awkward moments where I've had to explain to a kid that person has some kind of mental health problem, or that's some violence we're seeing there, that's poverty. And these are disturbing moments, but they are part of our world. And I don't have a greater claim to these streets, to these neighborhoods, than my neighbors. And there's all sorts of different social services, and my neighborhood has lots of different types of people living in it, but nothing like what you described. And I guess what reading your work challenged me to consider is, would I think very differently about these issues if it was in my backyard? So I want to understand where you have arrived. Are you against these centers?
I agree with the vast majority of everything you just said, okay? I've lived downtown my entire adult life. And yes, I agree. There are certain expected behaviors. There are people with schizophrenia. I have a brother with schizophrenia who's lived on the streets for 17 years. I'm acutely aware that we need to take care of people who in some respects can't
each
take
other.
Care of themselves.
Take care of each other.
Yes.
I'll also assume you got people in your life with drug problems.
Yeah, one of my best friends growing up died of an accidental overdose caused by fentanyl 2 years ago. I put him in the ground with my own hands. I'm very aware of the crisis. It's touched me. I'm very aware of mental health issues, certainly in the city. But that doesn't change certain facts, okay? These sites, and a lot of people, if you don't live near one, what you don't understand is that safe supply and injection sites are two different things. When people come to an injection site, they don't get the drugs there. There's a pharmacy right across from the injection site. Clients in the safe supply program were going to the pharmacy, filling their prescription for, 30 pills of 8-milligram hydromorphone, which is a pharmaceutical opioid, very, very strong. And then they were meeting, and we all know that the cars that the drug dealers were driving, because we saw them every day, and were meeting and essentially trading their prescription pills for either, foil, fentanyl, or in some cases cash, but usually it was for street fentanyl, because street fentanyl is many, 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 many times more powerful. Yeah. They're purchasing the drugs. It's street drugs. And primarily nowadays it's fentanyl. And so the people who use these sites rely on street dealers to get their drugs. Okay. And one inevitability or an inevitable consequence of these sites, especially in a downtown area like Leslieville or South Riverdale, is that what you get is the site also dispenses needles. People call it a needle exchange. It's not a needle exchange. There's no exchanging. The needles only go out one way. There's no obligation to return them. Okay. And because there's needles being distributed there, and because the drug dealers inevitably flock to the site, a lot of the activists, if you bring up the fact that drug dealers are required for this service.
Nobody can inject in a safe injection site unless they have something to inject, and they're not getting it from the pharmacy.
Correct. And so what ended up happening was drug dealers ended up encircling this site. And I've been on television programs where I've been debating, like, the executive director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. If you talk about drug dealers outside the site, they say, well, it's just a service. Like, if somebody was shot outside of a mall, would you close the mall down? If somebody was shot outside a hospital, would you close the hospital down? And a lot of what I will have to say is this kind of stuff is infuriating. There's a lot of these faulty comparisons going on. When Doug Ford introduced beer and wine and so forth into convenience stores recently, a lot of the harm reduction activists were outraged because, they literally, in all seriousness, compare, bartenders to street fentanyl dealers who are packing heat sometimes. And it's outrageous. Speaking of Pierre Poilievre, I mean, I don't need Pierre Poilievre or any politician to tell me what it's like to raise a family across the street from an injection site. I don't really care what Pierre Poilievre says. And I don't really care at this point what Justin Trudeau says either. All I know is that I live across the street from this place that requires drug dealers, okay, in order for the service to be provided, all right? And nobody wants to acknowledge that. And when you bring it up, they give you these, crazy comparisons about hospitals and malls. And they say, it's just a service. It's just a service. Well, it's not just a service.
I think I can hear your frustration. And I can appreciate your frustration given the story you just told me. It seemed like, I think that people with your point of view have been treated shabbily and dismissed in a way that I think is not really humane. Even the term NIMBY is like, there is, these are rich assholes who think that all of society needs to protect their kids from the harsh realities of the world. And meanwhile, these vulnerable people are dying. You quote this in your reporting. Your neighbors, who I think have pretty reasonable concerns, described as opportunistic opponents of a public health program who are trying to exploit the public's grief to undermine the hard-won shift in support for these services. What do activists do? This isn't an insult. They have an agenda. And I think that this conflict has made you the enemy of their agenda, and discrediting and vilifying your enemy that's an unfortunate part of politics. So I guess I'm hoping that we can have a conversation that's different than that.
Sure.
Because I still don't know what you think should be done, and I'm not sure about the way you describe it. Let me share with you my understanding of this based on the coverage I've done in the past. And I hope I'm not misrepresenting other people's point of view who are advocates of this stuff. I'm sure it's more detailed than this, but in general, Garth Mullins also is critical of these sites. Safe supply and harm reduction and safe injection advocates are critical of the way this has happened. And the point of view that's been shared with me is there are not enough of these things. We've only done a series of little experiments, so we can't say how effective they are.
a lot of, you know, Garth Melons, like, we didn't scale it up, right? We didn't have enough of them. I mean, first of all, I don't believe, having lived through what I've lived through, I don't think bricks and mortar injection sites are actually the way to go in most communities. I think other than areas where there's a really acute problem, such as, you know, East Side, Vancouver, downtown East Side, I think, you know, because otherwise you'll just end up with this really concentrated problem. And speaking of which, all of these studies into supervised injection sites around the world, there's tunnel vision. It's all about the clients. One of the reviews done of South Riverdale by a supervisor appointed by the province, who wrote a review, like a 40-page review of the place. One of the things that she noted in the review was that there's a dearth of studies on, you know, what are the impacts that these places have on neighborhoods.
Yeah, but we're moving all around the place. I mean, I think reasonable people would say that all of these people matter. Everybody matters here. But it's not just like...
Yeah, but I'm talking about the impact. The people impacted the most are the people who live in close proximity to these places. So, you know...
Well, no. And this isn't just some study. These are stats from Health Canada.
No. I'm talking...
Between January 2017 and May 2024, there were over almost 5 million visits to safe injection sites, almost 500,000 unique clients, and 58,000 plus non-fatal overdoses. The fact that 58,000 people who have drug addictions such that they will overdose, they will take too much fentanyl, take too much heroin, and they will overdose, and 58,000 times they did so in a place where their lives were saved, is not insignificant.
It's not insignificant. That matters,
right?
No, it's not insignificant, but if you want to get into numbers, some other numbers I would throw at you is that between 2020 and 2022, 89% of the overdose fatalities in Toronto were people who had previously been hospitalized for mental health afflictions, issues. Okay.
What do you make of that?
I would also point to a study that was done. It's online. People can read it. It was done by UBC. It's called the Hotel Study. It was a 10-year analysis of the intersection between mental health disorders and substance use disorders. And it had about 400 participants, and it spanned 10 years, okay? And 95% of the participants had a substance use disorder, 84% had a mental illness, and almost 50% of them, they all were given MRIs and brain scans. Almost 50% of them had brain damage. So what I'm saying is that South Riverdale, there is no on-site psychiatric mental health care, okay? The way I see...
Yeah,
these
are people with mental health issues who are self-medicating.
Yes, and we have no facility, no plan, no infrastructure to address that.
Like, I think that some people might be confused into thinking that we're having an argument.
No, we're not.
I'm not sure that we are. I want to get some clarity here because I think that we could shout statistics at each other. I think there's some pretty compelling research around some positive impacts of, I mean, they're different things, but Safe Supply has its own research. And then there's research around safe injection sites. Rather than fight about the warring research there, one thing that I hope we could agree on is that the Polyev concept, that what these people need is rehab and treatment, the stats are pretty conclusive there. Those are failed approaches. Diverting everybody to rehab and treatment, the relapse rate, the death rates are terrible. The idea that that's the solution to the drug crisis to me just seems like... It's so blithe, and what really lies behind it, I think, is just that this is not a prime minister, if he becomes one, who is going to actually fund enough beds of rehab and treatment to deal with this problem. There's no conservative agenda to, like, quadruple the amount of money we put into giving people free rehab in this country. What this is about is bulldozing these people out of sight and out of mind, and if they die, let them not die in front of me. And that's where it gets heated for me, is because I think that he's pretending to care about people he doesn't. And I don't see them as a lower class of people or a different class of people, because there's people I know. I'm sorry to get on this tangent. What I think maybe we even, you tell me, if these facilities did not exist in areas with as many families and kids as yours, if there were adequate numbers of these facilities, so it didn't all focus on one place, and very importantly, if addicts could get the drugs that they are addicted to, and they didn't have to go and sell them to illegal dealers for more strong narcotics that were maybe toxic and tainted. They didn't have to have street fights over the drugs. Nobody was there with a gun because there was no trade for illegal narcotics because people could just get what they wanted. We would have to swallow our own moral problem with governments providing people with really, really dangerous hard narcotics, which is, I think, a stigma that people is actually what's preventing this from getting to a better place. But if all of those things could exist, would you support that? Or do you feel like we need to get like tough on drugs? Like, where do you ultimately stand on this stuff? I'm still trying to figure it out.
I kind of have a theory that every time somebody equates, you know, bartenders to fentanyl dealers, another conservative politician is going to be elected at some point down the line. And I kind of feel the same way about, I feel like that about some of these protests going on in residential neighborhoods in our city, that every time there's one of those, a conservative politician is getting elected. But in terms of...
You're saying that the people who want to say, oh, it's no big deal if I can buy beer, why can't I get fentanyl? No, they're very different things.
Yes. And I feel like, you know, some of the things you're talking about, it's never good enough. So now you have some people on the other side saying, well, okay, maybe not having them so close to schools and daycares is a reasonable consideration. Well, that wasn't what they were saying before. And
you've been fighting people about a lot, but I'm asking you about a magical world in which the mental health issue is also addressed.
Yeah,
if they had security, if they had mental health services, and they had decriminalized legal hard narcotics that were, it's strange to call them non-toxic because you can die from these substances even when they're perfectly pure. But if all of those things existed, do you oppose that? Because the only other option I'm aware of is the tough on drugs. Like, I don't know, you could either throw them in jail.
I think this needs to be addressed first and foremost as a mental health crisis. And we're not currently doing that. The announcement that the Ford government made about these hard hubs, it sounds like that is one of the focuses of them, that they are planning to have mental health care as part of them. We'll see. I think that legalizing drugs is a non-starter. I don't think there's any political will to do it. So having that conversation is pretty much a waste of time. I think the Trudeau government is very, very gun shy on harm reduction right now. They know it's not helping them in the polls. And you've got Poilievre, as you just stated a little while ago, who's taking advantage of the unhappiness around that.
You and I know that there are a lot of people whose concern about these issues begins and ends with what they individually have to experience. They don't like to look at it. They don't like to see it. And whether or not it's actually a risk for them, they want it gone. And if these people go and die in a ditch, they're probably okay with that. There's a lot of, I think.
There's probably some people who like that for sure. And a lot of those people vote.
Yeah. So what do you want to see happen? Because I'm still struggling to kind of figure out
where I stand.
Yeah. I mean, look, Jesse, I think it's very reasonable to not want the situation in your neighborhood that you described. That's super reasonable.
I don't think these sites are feasible because especially in a community health center, I don't think a community health center has the ability to control what goes on outside of their building. They don't. They're only really focused on have the staff and understaffed, as you said, and they only have the ability to control what goes on inside. And as we already talked about, they can't control the drug dealers. Who can control the drug dealers? The police. Does the site want the police there? No. Is the Metro Toronto Police going to be focusing a lot of effort on some drugs, some small, you know, drug dealers around a supervised injection site that's rife with political divisiveness? No. So where does that leave the people who live and operate businesses around it? It leaves them wondering, should this be here? Should a site like this be within 200 meters of schools and daycares? My personal view is no, it shouldn't be. Now, the Ford government decided they're not opening anymore. Now, do I agree with that? Well, I didn't have a say. You know, my neighborhood was never consulted. Neither were the harm reduction advocates. None of us were consulted. And so neither side. So you know, the government made the decision they made. They're closing down 10 of these sites that are too close to schools.
Yes.
They've come up with a plan to open 19 of these, they're calling them heart hubs, that have a whole list, laundry list of services that are going to be customized to whatever neighborhood they're in. And So it's not like they didn't do anything. Now, these places haven't opened yet, so we can't critique them or analyze them.
They're closing 10 out of 38 sites that exist across the country. Ontario's closing 10. More than a quarter of the sites that exist are being closed.
10 of 17 sites in Ontario. You know, the other thing is a lot of people make a big stink about the fact that Doug Ford isn't allowing these to move to another location or he's not allowing any new ones. But the truth is, Jesse, we didn't know, okay, what, as I said in the beginning, what this was going to turn out to be. These places, in order to get their federal drug law exemption from Health Canada to operate in the first place, they have to basically demonstrate community buy-in. And now, given that everything that's happened around our site and other sites, we don't need Pierre Poilievre or any other politician saying anything. People already know what these sites mean and what they bring. And the odds of any community, yours, Summerhill, Rosedale,
nobody wants.
And I can almost guarantee that nowhere is going there. These sites are done because no communities at this point, it's extremely unlikely that they're going to get buy-in. So what Ford did was, in a way, the writing was already on the wall.
I think you're right. I think you're going to win. This was a nascent little experimental thing that we had 38 of in Canada. 10 are gone. Whatever the new ones are, they're probably not going to be quite the same. And I think it's going to be incredibly hard. Maybe they could have moved into some industrial area where, like, who knows if the addicts could even get there. Is that winning? If you kill this thing, is that a victory?
No, I don't see it. I don't see that. I think it's a net positive for our neighborhood in the sense that.
And I don't. I'm not trying. Like, you got to do what's right for you and your kids.
I don't think. Look, this is a serious problem, and I have a brother, as I said earlier, that who's only a year younger than me. He's lived on the streets for almost 20 years. He's a paranoid schizophrenic, and this might be part of the reason why I see this as a mental health crisis.
Isn't it all of these things?
Well,
your mental health crisis becomes an addiction crisis once you're addicted.
Well, and it's also a homeless crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, the homeless crisis is largely fueled by mental health problems as well.
It's like everything that you're fueling this argument with could lead to a conclusion of we need to vastly multiply the social services.
We do. We do. And that's why we haven't done it, because it's incredibly expensive. So when my brother gets picked up because he gets in a fight at the Toronto Public Library for trying to use a computer, or somebody's trying to butt in on him, or he gets, I get calls from a psychiatrist saying, hey, we have your brother. We've picked him up because he's been deemed either a threat to himself or a threat to someone else. Would you like to come and pick him up?
Yeah.
And my answer is, no, I'm not coming to get my brother because he's paranoid schizophrenic. He's been violent. I don't want him around my children. And you, our system doesn't allow family members to do anything. When he first went on the streets, his doctor said, your brother is most likely going to die with his rights. And that is what's happening. He's free to live on the streets and nobody's going to pick him up and put him in an asylum like we did back in 1890. But he's going to die out there. To be honest with you, if it was me, if I was the health minister, I would take the money that is put into these supervised consumption sites and I would put it into non-physical address outreach workers who can go to the people where they are, mobile offerings.
They had some stuff like that in Thunder Bay when I was reporting there.
Yeah, that I would put all my money to that, and our site was running without any on-site psychiatric care. Like to me, if you look at the numbers, even if you just look with your own eyes at what's going on around it, who the clients are and what the problems are they're having and how they're suffering and the psychosis they're suffering from, it's so clearly, to a large extent, a mental health crisis. Even the people in the sites wish they had more access to psychiatric care.
There is no easy solution to this. I don't know where to leave this, but to say that, I feel like the battle that you've been fighting, you're going to win. I worry about what we're going to be left with.
So do I.
Really appreciate you talking with me about this, Derek.
Thanks, Jesse. It's good to be here.
That's your Canada Land podcast. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Max Collins is our production manager. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We're going to talk about the Liberal MP who has been called out on Instagram by another Liberal MP. Mostly, we're going to talk about how much the press hates and openly disrespects Jagmeet Singh, and how this time, they might be wrong about him. Canadian journalism royalty is with us. It is Jan Wong, professor, writer, teacher, scholar. How you doing? Welcome back to the show.
Royalty. That's so last century, but thank you.
We're starting with the top story in Ottawa. The NDP's deal with the Liberals is over.
I notified the Prime Minister that I've ripped up the supply and confidence agreement.
And now sellout Singh has pulled a stunt.
Why he dumped the boyfriend but is still seeing him behind his back.
There's nothing more important to these greedy politicians than collecting a pension.
It's not even a very dignified way to break up.
It's a pure political calculation decision.
Jan, I want to catch up with you on this news of Jagmeet Singh and the NDP's decision to tear up the deal with the Liberals. The press has really been giving it to him. Like, people do not think much of this guy. Can I read some headlines to you?
Yes, please.
This spans left to right. National Observer, Jagmeet Singh just played himself. National Post, Jagmeet Singh faces demolishing what's left of his credibility. Globe and Mail, opinion piece. Jagmeet Singh says to NDP caucus, we've accomplished basically nothing, so our work here is done. The Hub, conservative publication The Hub, how Trudeau duped Singh and Polyev schooled them both. The Beaverton, dunking on Jagmeet Singh. Jagmeet Singh asserts independence by doing exactly what Pierre Polyev told him to. Everybody thinks this guy is an absolute clown. Like, it's just headline after headline. Am I an idiot in thinking this might be a smart move from Jagmeet Singh?
Well, I hate to say, but I totally agree with you. And I don't understand why the media is all talking out of the same, you know, template. I think it's brilliant.
Maybe we're both idiots.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's look at the situation here. He's had this alliance and he can claim that this was just practical politics. I wasn't going to be prime minister, but I could actually get dental care and some things done through this alliance. But now the Trudeau popularity is in the toilet. And they've shaved off, I don't know, it was like 15, 20 points. None of that action's gone to me. It's all gone to Polyev. I'll just continue going down with him. But he hasn't gained anything, which is embarrassing. All of that has shifted over to Polyev. But he hasn't really lost anything either. Because what he's done is he's divorced himself from Trudeau. Now he's lashing out at Trudeau and saying they're not up for the job of taking on Polyev, but we are.
Trudeau's Liberals can't deliver change. They are too weak and too selfish to stop Pierre Polyev and the Conservatives. In the next federal election, Canadians will get to choose between Polyev's Conservative cuts or the hopeful future that new Democrats can bring.
I think the timing was good. I think it's a smart move. He got through as best he could the dental care and the pharma care. Trudeau is tanking. There's a by-election coming up in Montreal-Verdun, September 16th. It's just enough time to break. And I think it was like before he was like Mike Pence, and now he's Kamala Harris. I think he's figured it out. And I don't understand why the Canadian media was all asking these stupid questions. They were just irritatingly dumb. Like, oh, well, if you think he's such a loser, why did you stick with him for so long? Well, that's called, you know, a coalition government. And those are sometimes our best governments. That's how we got Medicare. Tommy Douglas was a minority in the government. He had a coalition and he pushed that through. That was his condition. And I think Singh is seeing what's going to happen. He's seeing Trudeau is not leaving, even though his own Liberals want him out. So he's made a very astute choice. And I'm surprised we both agree. This is like the only time we agree. So I'm a little nervous.
Well, I know. I mean, I have my own bias here. And my bias is that this is interesting. It's the first interesting thing to happen in Canadian federal politics mm-hmm. in a while. So I'm like, oh, like maybe this guy's up to something because, you know, it's kind of do or die. I think it's his last stand. But if he can make this work, there is a reality that I can see where he ends up the official opposition. Like, this isn't a play to be prime minister.
Or who knows, right?
I know he's not prime minister.
You know, I always dream big.
You bring up the way the media is responding, asking him dumb questions about his previous support for the Liberals. Why did you support them for so long if you felt so poorly of them? They're also asking him, like, they think they've really got him with this one line of questioning. I want to play you this clip here of like, they've been hammering him with these questions about now that he's taken a swing at the Liberals, well, does that mean that he's going to, like, bring them down tomorrow, and they keep hammering him on that. First, here is Brian Lilly from the Toronto Sun grilling Jagmeet.
You've said about a dozen times at least that you've ripped up the agreement and that that makes an election more likely. But you've been asked several times and you won't answer. Do you have confidence in the Trudeau government as they stand now?
I will be clear again. We have absolutely ripped up the agreement with Justin Trudeau, and that means an election is more likely.
That's not clear. You're
and an election, whenever that election comes, we'll be ready to fight it. And the vision around that election is going to be an important one. Canadians will have to make a choice.
But can we get an answer?
Corporate-controlled conservatives, they're going to let their corporate buddies rip you off even more, or New Democrats are going to save you money on your rent and your groceries. That's a choice that Canadians will have to make.
Can we get an answer?
I will look at any vote that comes before us, and we will make a decision in the best interest of Canadians, as any minority government normally operates.
And here is a tough interview from CTV's chief political correspondent Vashi Kapelos interviewing Jagmeet Singh.
You stayed in it as long as you did to get things done. So if those things aren't done, why aren't you continuing to stay in it unless there's some kind of political interest in it for you to move to a different position, which is what the Liberals essentially are accusing you of. They say blatantly, Karina Gold on this
dental
program last night, you put your own interests ahead of Canadians.
Dental care is done.
Do you not feel like you bear any responsibility for being unable to capitalize on the Liberals' fall from grace among Canadians?
We're going to be running to form government in the next election. I'm running for prime minister.
Respectfully, that's not really an answer. Like, are you worried at all about the fact that you haven't been able...
Respectfully, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm running for prime minister. I'm running to beat the Conservatives. I'm running to make sure that this country has someone that's going to be on their side.
She hammers them, and she's been praised for this interview, Jan, that this is a real tough accountability interview.
Oh, I think it's embarrassing.
Why? Tell me.
Well, okay. So first of all, this confidence. Do you have confidence in the Trudeau government? Confidence is a technical parliamentary term. It's there's certain kinds of votes that if they get defeated, the government falls. That's what it means for confidence. When they're asking him, do you have confidence in the Trudeau government? That's not the same thing. They're using the term in a sneaky way. It's just like a stupid question. He's going to go issue by issue and he's going to decide. And the reporters know that, but they don't care. They just want to make him look like he's dodging. Do you have confidence in the Trudeau government is not the question. And the second one, it was like, she's saying, I'm asking you respectfully, blah, blah, blah. I can see why people don't want to watch TV anymore. And to say, you know, oh, he's so political. Well, they are literally politicians.
He's a politician. That's the part that embarrassed me was when she's like she really thought she had something there. Like, I'm going to ask you once again, are you doing this for idealistic reasons, or are you just being political?
Yeah.
He's a politician. So the question is, like, if you were a man of integrity and you hate the Liberals so much, you wouldn't vote for them on anything. And he can very easily answer, I am a pragmatic person who is going to vote for what's best for people. And if the Liberals have a really good, like, no, we know that that's not necessarily true. He's going to try to time it for the best time possible for his chances to,
because he's a politician.
Because he's a politician. Like, is that, like, that's what she's trying to reveal, that he's a politician.
What's sad is that by making this simplistic, there is no attention being paid to any policy. They're just trying to get a gotcha moment with this foolish conflation of the two meanings of confidence. And I really do blame the media, and I'm just shocked. And I'm a reporter, and I like reporters. And I'm going, is no one awake in the newsroom? What are the editors doing? Like, why are they not in the ear of the reporter saying, don't ask that. You've already asked that. Ask him about specific policies. Like, what issue would he vote against? What is the critical budget issue that he would vote against the government to trigger an election? Because Singh is not going to be popular when he finally does trigger this, because Canadians hate elections. They hate going to elections.
I think that's why they're mad at him. They're like, answer me again. Can I plan my vacation for this fall or not?
I don't get it.
I'll ask you one more time. The tickets are non-refundable.
I know. It's like, can we get a little content here? Why are we listening to these shouting questions? And then they post it on their Twitter account thinking they're so heroic. It's like, come on, you're asking the same stupid question. It's a stupid question. Stop asking it. Once is bad enough. I actually feel sorry for Jagmeet Singh.
I mean, look, you know, you can't act super surprised. The Canadian media has historically refused to show respect or give adequate coverage to the NDP, right? Like, and, you know, we revere and glorify Jack Layton now, but while he was alive, they took every shot at him that they could.
Yes.
They refused to take the NDP seriously, and then they say, oh, why don't people take the NDP seriously? And I also feel like there might be some level of racism in the Jagmeet Singh coverage.
Yes.
He is not just a racialized person, but he's, as I've covered before on Canada, just a snappy dresser. He's more peacocky than Canadian politicians typically are, though in a Justin Trudeau era, I'm not sure if that still holds.
I don't know about the racism. I can't tell, but his treatment is embarrassing, the way the media is treating him.
I'm often paralyzed by seeing things from too many perspectives at once. And while I feel like strategically this is a super smart and interesting thing, I also have never heard the guy open his mouth and felt myself like rise to my feet and thought, that is so well said. That is a great speaker. This guy's smart as a tack. I've never been impressed with the guy. So,
yeah,
you know, that might be part of this as well.
But it's all relative, right? You line him up against Justin and Polly Ever, and it's like, oh, okay.
It ain't Mensa. Jan Wong, duly noted, you're up first.
Sure. I'll start off talking about TIFF, which is going on right now in Toronto, the Toronto International Film Festival. And I just like to say, it doesn't feel very international. Their definition of international seems to be Hollywood, white people, Europe. And yes, they do other films, of course. I'm not blaming TIFF as much as I'm blaming the media coverage. Like, they all want to go, oh, this star is in town, and they're all the Hollywood people. And I think the media is ignoring Korean culture, for instance. I'm really a big fan of Korean films. And they had this big star come in, Hoon Bin, and he's the lead actor on Crash Landing on You, and he's done a whole bunch of other stuff. And I just think the media is so focused on people who can speak English, and they're missing the fact that the city of Toronto is so diverse. But you don't have to be Korean. I don't know any Korean. I've never been to Korea. I'm totally into the Korean films. And the interesting thing behind this is the Korean government deliberately decided to promote their culture as an export in the 1990s. And it's called the Hallyu, which means the Korean wave, because they saw this as a way, you'll love this, to market Korean products like LG and Kia cars. You watch these films and it's hilarious because they really promote this stuff.
But Parasite and everything else, that had this huge artistic kind of wave, this huge renaissance and interest.
Yeah, Parasite won the Oscar, and you have all the K-pop. I don't like K-pop. BTS, that's not my thing.
But was government policy, huh? That was government cultural policy.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
They funded it. In Canada, we're always talking about funding the arts. Korea definitely went all out to fund it. And they're making a lot of money off it, their Korean dramas and their own products. The LG stove. I just bought an LG stove.
It works.
It works.
The marketing works. Well, shut my cultural subsidy critical mouth. Duly noted. Can I share a story that I don't think people paid nearly enough attention to?
Sure.
We have been covering, for a long time now, this story about this brain disease in New Brunswick and the cover-up. And that story has had some developments. A lot of it is just because other media have started paying attention. some Canadian media, but really noteworthy, the New York Times and People magazine, of all things, have picked up the story on what is going on with this unexplained and debilitating disease in New Brunswick that hundreds and hundreds of people are suffering from, and why won't the government try to find out? What I want to duly note today is one, I think, pretty major progression in the story and pretty remarkable thing to have happen. An MP from Fredericton, Jenica Atwin, who is a Liberal MP, published a very terse open letter to the Liberal Minister of Health, Mark Holland, about this issue. This is a Liberal MP publicly calling out the Liberal Health Minister. Dear Minister Holland, I'm writing to you today out of grave concern regarding the cluster of neurological illnesses in New Brunswick. As you are well aware, the Provincial Oversight Committee stated in 2022 that all the 48 cases they studied were quote-unquote known illnesses, and they sidelined any potential federal studies. This is what Canada Land reported, and we're seeing this here like an inter-liberal calling out here, and she is reminding the health minister that under the Department of Health Act, it is the legal duty of Public Health Canada to step in and study the epidemiology and pathology of such a public health anomaly. And she actually included the hashtag on her Instagram post of this letter, hashtag glyphosate. Glyphosate is the herbicide that is linked to this unexplained debilitating neurological disease. It is used extensively in New Brunswick by the forestry industry. And the biggest company that has been pushing for years to keep this legal on behalf of glyphosate use is the biggest forestry company in New Brunswick, Irving Limited.
Okay, so let me jump in here with just a few little things. I know this is your duly noted, but I have to say a couple of things. Blaine Higgs, the premier of New Brunswick, because I used to work there, he worked for Irving for 33 years. Like, there's a connection here. And the government, it wasn't Blaine Higgs himself, I think it was a previous government that fired the chief medical officer of health, Eilish Cleary. She was in the middle of researching glyphosate. She just got fired and they said, oh, it had nothing to do with her research. And then one last thing I want to add about Jenica Atwin. She was the MP in my riding in Fredericton, and she originally ran as a Green, and all the students were helping her win and putting up money. I probably donated to her campaign because it seemed like very hard for the Greens to get in. And then she won, and guess what? She crossed the floor. So I was really mad at her, but I'm so glad she wrote this letter. So there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in New Brunswick with the power, right? I would love to know if she's talked to Blaine Higgs about this letter that she wrote to her own health minister. It's very interesting. I don't know what's happening, but maybe it's the media coverage. Maybe it's been a little embarrassing for New Brunswick to have Canada Land and the New York Times and People magazine all descending on them.
It's hard to get people outside of Atlantic Canada to care about New Brunswick, but this story is going to be increasingly a big deal, is my prediction. And it's a story that we have played a big role. I'll credit Sarah Larniak and other people here for doing that, and Cherie Sutrin, but it's not a story that began with us. And Jack Poitras for CBC has been doing a lot of coverage of the Irvings and of the glyphosate file and what's going on with research in New Brunswick and academia and what's going on with lobbying. It's all part of the same story. I'll duly note all of it for you.
Duly noted.
Okay, that's our show for today. Thank you for joining me. Listen, you may have noticed that we have been making some changes to the format of this show. Love to know what you think about it. Email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. This episode was produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Tune in. in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC 101.9 FM has opened applications for its 2024-2025 Musicians in Residence program. Young and emerging artists are encouraged to apply to use CFRC studio space as an incubator to create new music, perform it live on air with video simulcast, take part in industry-related workshops for bands who are just starting out, and get paid. Learn more and apply today at cfrc.ca.
Kick your shoes off at the door.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcast.